about that. But I can't get to the barber because they're like forbidden, right? It's dangerous. So that's not a bad idea. I noticed Jeremy, it looked like you were getting kind of shaggy maybe. I don't know how. But then, of course, Brother Stevens doesn't need to worry about that. And Brother Dave, he's looking good. He doesn't have to worry about that. Years ago, I read an article. It was about, the title of the article was something like The Power Forehead. And it was about famous people that had that were bald, and they just looked really dignified, and they just really had it. And I remember the one that reminded me the most of Brother Stevens was Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford had you got Gerald Ford's power forehead, brother. I can't remember, Brother Dave. Yeah, I can't remember which one you resembled the most. I'd have to go back and find the article, but. Thought of something interesting today. I was working. We're staying with my parents, and it's kind of a basement apartment, and there's a bedroom, of course, and a bathroom, and living area, and a kitchen. But there's no study. There's a table in the living area, but usually I study in the bedroom, and I just sit on the bed. But if you spend a long time in the bed, maybe you start to get uncomfortable. You want to find some other position. So I just grabbed a chair from the corner that's been there for a long time, and then I realized that chair was the same chair I sat in when I was in junior high, in high school, doing my schoolwork. They still have that chair. That was interesting. I was sitting there, with no books in the Bible, just one book, the Bible, on the bed working on a lesson. I thought that was kind of cool. All right, we're going to be in 2 Corinthians. Chapter 10, 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Now, I bet if I say 2 Corinthians chapter 10, some of you are already guessing. Is he going to go to what? Verses 4 and 5? Is he going to go to verses 4 and 5? Well, the answer is yes, but we're going to start with verse 3. Verse 3. Let's pray first and ask the Lord to bless. Father, of course, this isn't the ideal situation, at least that's what we feel. But we know that you work in many ways, and so this is just good for you. And I'm sure that you're doing your work, and those that are listening can receive your word as it is from the Bible. I pray, Father, you help us here. Help me to deliver it as I would if it was just a normal congregation in that manner, Father. Mainly, I just want to just be able to give it to everyone that's listening in the way that would benefit them. We ask it for Jesus' sake. Amen. All right, so this is a famous passage, and we'll start in verse 3. It says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ, and having in a readiness to revenge all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled." And so these are 4 and 5 is a set of verses that we memorized in Bible school so many years ago. And I always put little circles by them when I memorize them. So I got the same Bible that I had in Bible school, and the circles are still there. They haven't rubbed off yet. Memorize these verses. But over the years, somehow they've come to feel that kind of, because everyone likes to refer to them, and they've been, it's always easy to go back to these verses. I mean, there's a lot here. But I felt that they've almost become kind of a cliché. Because maybe it's just like because I can quote them so easily, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. And you know, that sounds bad to quote it like that, but my point being is that it's this chunk of scripture, and sometimes I want to say, but it doesn't work. Have you ever said that? It doesn't work. But now that's not right, because it should work, okay? Such a dense passage is so much here referring to weapons of warfare are mighty through God and so on. It should work. And so how can we think of it like that? Well, so I started working on it, and of course I figured that the reason it probably doesn't work is there's probably some things I don't know about it, something maybe I haven't been paying attention to about it. So I got studying, and I realized, you know, there's about 10 times as much here as I originally thought. There's a bunch. So we're going to work on it tonight. And so even though this is a common passage and you've read it many times and perhaps memorized it, if I don't give you something new tonight, I'll eat my hat. I don't wear a hat, so I'll shave my head, okay? If I don't give you something new tonight, I'll shave my head. Okay, I heard you guys aren't saving these. That's good, okay. All right, verse chapter 3. It says, "For though we walk in the flesh," we walk in the flesh. This is where all the trouble comes from, in my book. We walk in the flesh. maybe you'll say, well, doesn't some of your trouble come from your heart? I mean, you walk in your flesh, but what about your heart? Your heart is wicked. Yeah, it's my heart, but my heart loves God too, but then my flesh influences my heart. So I'm still going to blame it on my flesh. At least I feel like I want to do that. I want to say it's because I walk in the flesh. But maybe I should say more precisely, it's what the flesh produces in my heart and mind. Okay, that makes things so difficult for a Christian in this life. I'm going to refer to a couple things in Romans chapter 8. You can flip over there if you want, but I'll read them. And he says in Romans chapter 8, Paul, "They that are in the flesh cannot please God." They that are in the flesh cannot please God. So that's definitely a problem. If we walk in the flesh, and Paul says we are in the flesh, that's a big problem. Maybe it's the root of almost every problem, if not every problem. There's part of my heart that loves God, but there's this other part. And my carnal mind is at... these two parts, they're at enmity with each other. The part of my heart that loves God and my carnal mind. They're enemies. They're at enmity with each other. And so that, it makes things hard. But maybe that's a good thing. You say, well, that's been real troublesome to me. I don't know why you call it a good thing. Well, think of it this way. If you didn't have this conflict, if there wasn't this enmity, hey, that means you're really in trouble. Okay, then you're really in trouble. The reason is because that's like a lost person without Jesus Christ at all. And when Paul gets on down there, you know, in verse 7, he makes a statement, a general statement about the carnal mind. And I think he's going back and in including all lost people. Okay, a general statement that includes all lost people, because, of course, Romans is a, well, it's written to all the Romans. He says lost my spot. Okay. The carnal mind is enmity with God. It is. And if you don't have Jesus Christ, that's you. You're just a carnal mind. And your carnal mind is enmity with God. It's not at enmity, but it is enmity. That's its identity. It's not sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, it is. It's the very nature of the carnal mind. And without being born again, that's all you have. That is your mind. It is a carnal mind. But for us now, he says it a little different in verse 6. He says, to be carnally minded is death. Okay, that's one way of being. To be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. That's another way. So then why did he leave us to walk in the flesh? So we'll get back to that question. Why did he leave us to walk in the flesh? But actually, to answer that, that'd be like a whole other, that's a whole lesson to explore that. Why would he actually do that to us, leave us this way? But he did. Okay, so we won't work on that tonight. But what we found out is that you don't have to walk carnally, right? You don't have to walk carnally. Some walk carnally, carnally minded is death, but there are others who are spiritual minded, and you can walk after the spiritual mind. And Brother Stevens, he called that their route, okay? A couple lessons back. They're going to walk after the flesh. Verse 9, though, in Romans there, but ye are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if so be that the Spirit of God dwell in you. So now I'm confused, because I'm walking in the flesh, but Paul just said I'm not in the flesh, but in the Spirit. Okay? Are you confused? I hope I confused you. I was kind of intending to confuse you. We're going to try to figure this out a little bit tonight, because in Corinthians, he's telling us to do some things even though we walk in the flesh, right? Though we walk in the flesh. All right, so let's go. Let's turn back over there to 2 Corinthians 10 there. Though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. We do not war after the flesh. So we need a walk of war that is not in the flesh. Okay? We war, right? But we do not walk in the flesh. But if we're going to war, we're in the flesh, so we need a walk of war. You follow my reasoning? But Brother Jeremy, just the other night, he was saying that we run, right? And we have to run and run and keep, we have to keep running when we can't stop. Which which is it? Am I walking or am I running? I'm not picking on Brother Jeremy. I'm just trying to make sure that you're as confused as I am. Because Brother David also said that sometimes we should stand still, right? And I also know that the Bible in another place says that sometimes we should sit, right? Sit at the feet of Jesus. Or maybe there are certain times you're supposed to flee. Okay? So how are we going to reconcile all these things? Actually, we don't have to. Okay? Each one of them illustrates something about our Christian life. And it's not a physical life. It's not a natural life like I talked about last time. It's a spiritual life. And so we can use different things that we're familiar with in our physical life to understand what's going on in our spiritual life. So you're not going to make like a comprehensive system of all this stuff. I mean, you might be able to, you know, I've tried to draw the spirit and the mind and the heart and what else? Did I miss any part? No, there's just, and then the flesh, of course, and you know, maybe it helps, but it's all these parts are your non-physical, part of your non-physical existence, and you're not going to be able to draw a nice picture and figure it out. But we are going to understand some of the relationships, and especially tonight, we're going to learn how to walk the walk of war, though we walk in the flesh. And we're going to learn how to do these things that Paul has said we should do and that we can do in verses 4 and 5. But it does seem confusing, and I won't say that it's easy. I do think sometimes it is hard, maybe sometimes very hard, and that's why some Christians, they just give up. They say, this type of thing is too hard. I think I'll just go back to running after the flesh. I'll just follow my flesh, because that's just the one thing, and I've always been able to do that, And that seemed to work out well enough, although after all it was going to put me in hell. But now that I'm saved, I don't have to worry about that. And so this trying to walk after the Spirit and all that is kind of hard. So I think I'll just walk after the flesh. It'd be easier. I think a lot of Christians end up like that. The walk of war requires a couple things that you understand clearly. Okay? You need to understand there are two things, two entities. There's you and the enemy, right? This is basic, and anytime we talk about fighting or something like that, you could probably throw that in. There's you and the enemy. Okay? See, isn't there any innocence alive? I've read that innocents get killed in war and stuff, and I've read stories. In this spiritual battle that we fight, there is no innocent. There is ignorant, blind, deceived. But everything in our spiritual life, you can classify as part with the enemy or with God. It's if you're going to be on God's side, that's you. There's you, and there's the enemy. And so the walk of war means you're always watching for the enemy, right? It's a war. They're trying to kill you. Your enemy is after you, and unless you're off the battlefield and resting somewhere, I mean, that's possible during wartime. You get pulled back, and you get to go on leave or something like that. But, you know, it depends on how far away you are from the front lines. Maybe there's an enemy in the city you're resting in too, so maybe you should be being careful. And I've read some stories of the enemy chasing after special targets in the cities and stuff like that, you know, so you're not necessarily safe even in those situations. So if you're going to walk the walk of war, you have to be watching for the enemy at all time. But what I'm illustrating is especially when you're on patrol, if a group of men, a squad or something, or maybe less than a squad, moving through enemy territory or an area where they know for sure that the enemy is, it's them or anything else, they will assume it's the enemy, okay? And as they walk, they're always observing. They're always observing. If they walk in a line, you know, maybe a squad, and there's one guy in front, and he'd be on the point, and then each one follows maybe several paces apart. Each one would have his sector that he's watching in. Okay, the guy on point, he's going to be watching in front. Okay, and then after that, then the next guy, maybe you'd be watching on the right front, and then the next guy the left front. And then following back, you know, it'd be out to the sides and stuff like that. And the guy in the back is going to be paying attention to see if maybe anyone's trying to sneak up on him. That is, each guy has his own sector, and he's watching and observing, and he's observing intently, okay? Intently, that's the key. They're not just, you know, it's not just a summer day and, you know, checking out the trees and the birds and so on. They're watching intently. Because there's only one thing that they need to discern, whether or not the enemy is in the vicinity or can see them. Okay? And so as they move along slowly. They're not just stomping through the woods. And they have all of their equipment taped down, so there's no clanking, no sound whatsoever. They're not smoking as they go along. Okay. They're not talking as they go on. Absolutely, they're not talking. They just, you know, give ham signals, or they get guys that get used to each other. They just read each other's facial expressions and so on. They're not talking at all. They're making no sound at all. When they walk, they're not stomping. They're not walking quickly. Each step they take, they reach forward with the ball of their feet. Okay, and then they settle in because they don't want any crunching sound. Okay, and they take step and step. In step, and it's real slow, okay? But they're not thinking about how slow they're going. They're trying to read their environment. They're trying to observe. They're trying to drill into the foliage and see if they can see anything. And why they're this careful every step is because they're searching for an enemy position. An enemy position might be protected by booby traps or something like that. Or there might actually be an ambush set up for a patrol just like them or something like that. Or there, maybe the enemy has a listening post out and they don't, and that guy's not moving. He's just sitting there watching. So they don't want to just like run into him or something. And so they're listening and watching. And every step they take, it means they are now, there's a new line of sight. That is, if there was an enemy soldier somewhere in the front of them or somewhere, and they didn't see him the last few steps because there was something like a tree or something, then the next step changes that line of sight, and now he can see him. Okay? So if they were safe 10 minutes ago, now they're not anymore. Okay? Maybe three steps back, no one could see you, but the next three steps, you're in the line of sight of an enemy. So it's better if you see him first before he sees you. So that's how they travel through the woods, and they can go along like that, you know, for hours. They don't travel very fast. They're listening to the wildlife, or what kind of sounds are the birds making? What kind of sounds are the insects making? Or maybe an absence of sound, and so on. Now, why am I going into all this detail about how they patrol? I'll get that in a minute. There's one more thing I want to explain about how they patrol, and that is especially for the guy that's the squad leader or the head of the team, he needs to maintain a certain kind of detachment, okay? He can't get too absorbed in everything that the patrol is doing. And so usually the team leader, he doesn't go on point, okay, because he can't do two jobs like that at once. That is, he's going along and he's observing, but then he's also like, in his mind, he's setting himself back and watching the whole process or observing the whole thing as a movement of the whole team. And the reason is because, if they see something in front or they even start taking fire from the front, he can't just concentrate on the front and forget about the flanks or the sides. Okay, he has to think about, well, you know, as soon as we get into this spot, if we take fire from the front and we have to try to break contact because it's overwhelming or something like that, which direction am I going to go? Okay, so he's going to be thinking about all those things. That is, he has to maintain a kind of detachment, okay, as he patrols. Okay, now, what I want to say is that as you patrol through your own mind, and that's what we're going to do tonight, as you patrol through your own mind, you need to, you can have this kind of detachment. Okay, and this is what we're going to learn about this evening. So, if we're talking about the walk of war and patrolling, we're going to do a little bit of patrolling through our own mind this evening. Okay, and you're going to have to have a certain kind of attachment. Otherwise, you won't pay attention. You won't pick up on the things that we want to observe and deal with. Okay, and what kind of things are we looking for if we continue on and we go into verse 4? We're looking for strongholds, right? You see that? We're looking for strongholds, and our objective is to pull them down, Now, I've read stories about guys going into, you know, like, during the Vietnam War, going into Cambodia and Laos, and these were areas where the North Vietnamese, they had all kinds of strongholds and stuff like that, and they would hide back there because there wasn't supposed to be any war in those areas. And I've read stories about guys going along and they didn't see nothing, and then the next couple steps they look around and they're like in the middle of a bunker system. Okay, the enemy bunker system, and they didn't see it coming in because it's all camouflage, but now they get to a certain point and they see the openings and so on. That's a stronghold. That's an enemy stronghold. And if you're not going to look for them, you're not going to see them. And if you're going to pull these things down and you're not going to look, you won't find them. So you have to go through and patrol like you mean it. Like it's a walk of war, and you have to have a detachment that is in the sense that You understand that you are not your mind, okay? And you are not your heart, and you are not your feelings. And I think we can say that actually, in another sense, you are not just your thoughts, okay? No, you have thoughts, and in many ways, your thoughts define who you are. But your very personage is not just your thoughts, okay? And so we're going in, and we're moving through, and we're watching for these things. We're looking for those strongholds. I'll tell you what: if you won't patrol your mind in this fashion, you will never win in the Christian life. You've got to do some of it. Otherwise, you're just stomping through, and you're just going to be wiped out. That is, as far as what's going on in your head, you've lost already if you never patrol it. If you've ever been overtaken in a sin and you didn't know how it happened, you just weren't paying attention. You weren't patrolling. You weren't watching for the enemy, and just wham, they got you, and it was over before you even knew it started. Okay, so the environment that we're patrolling this evening is our mind, and we're watching for strongholds. Now, where do these strongholds come from? In the rest of verse 5, he mentions imaginations and thoughts, right? He says, "And every high thing." Those are three things that he lists: thoughts, imaginations, high things. Now, I see these things as see these words as a kind of a progression. Okay, that is, a stronghold is the end of the progression of these things. Try to follow what I'm saying. That is to say, thoughts can be anything, right? Thoughts can be very, very fleeting. Half a second, quarter of a second, you think about this, think about that. It's not necessarily connected to anything. It'd pop in your head and be gone before you even know it. Right? Do you ever like just observe your thoughts as they're bouncing around in there? Or have you ever thought about like what's the general tenor of your thoughts? Are they agitated, for example? And that would be like if you're going along and the wildlife is starting to get stirred up and make noise, right? Are your thoughts agitated? Or maybe you're going along and all of a sudden all the wildlife and the bugs even they're quiet. They're not making any noise. The noise they usually make, they don't make. So maybe sometimes the tenor of your thoughts is just like lazy or dull. But have you ever noticed? I mean, I could say that, you know, my thoughts are just, somebody asks you what you think about. I'm not thinking about anything, you know. Your wife probably asks you that. What do you think about, honey? I'm not thinking about anything. But, I mean, unless you're trying to do Zen Buddhism or something like that, you say that you're not thinking about anything, but there's probably stuff going on in your head. You say you're not thinking about anything because you're not really even aware of what's going on. And so... If you're patrolling in the jungle and all of a sudden the crickets stop chirping and there ain't no birds making any sound at all, what does that mean? That probably means that you're getting close to some ambush position and the enemy has shifted to get ready to blow you away. And they made a little bit of noise and the birds took notice. And so they stop. So if you find that you don't know what you're thinking about, and you think you're just not thinking about anything, probably you got some other stuff going in the back of your head, and it's fixing to organize and do some damage. You just don't even know it. Those thoughts are organizing. That becomes imagination. Imaginations are organized thoughts. They're about something. It's a scenario or developing something. Okay, it has it's a content. That's starting a story or something about that. It's going somewhere. That's what imaginations are. And once those thoughts start to form those imaginations, then you're really in danger. Because if those the organization of those thoughts is not God, doesn't come from a pure mind, and is not stimulated by spiritual things, then it's something else entirely. It's not just like random. It's the enemy. Okay? It's going to be the enemy. You say, wow, that's going to be really tiring. Well, I don't know what to say. I think you got to patrol like this sometimes. I won't say that I even go around like this all day long patrolling my mind, because I'm not, okay? But I do it, okay? And I understand that these things are happening in my head, okay? And so I'm going to try to help you with it some tonight. It says, high things. High things. You probably already got some of these. You probably already got some high things in your head. Now, I used to, you know, if you read other commentators and stuff, they'll suggest that the high things are like thoughts of pride, something like that, right? Which kind of makes sense. I mean, I don't mind thinking about it like that. But I think all of the imaginations that are not for God, that don't come from a pure mind and eventually develop into a high things, it's called high because this is what now exalts itself against the knowledge of God, right? So it's a high thing. Can you think of another word for that? It's called it would be a high place. What do they put on top of high places? Idols. This high thing that you've allowed to form in your head, that's an idol. And it exalts itself against the knowledge of God. It's something that we have built in our mind that's, we have allowed it to become higher than God. It's above God. And for us, it's preferred before God. That's how we see it. There's all kinds of idols. It's not just the wood ones or the stone ones that we read about in the Scripture or back in the Old Testament times. There is all kinds of idols. Our head might have all kinds of idols in it. It could be an activity that you prefer before, you know, going and get preached at or something like that. That you would much rather do than go to church on Sunday two times. You know, some kind of activity. Or, you know, just any activity that you practice inordinately. You know, it's just that's what you want to do. If you have any free time, that's what I want to do. Maybe it's a game. Maybe it's reading novels. Maybe it's watching movie. Maybe it's social media and stuff like that. And we like to talk about that and or get on that one. But, you know, it could even be something like gardening. You know, could be something like that. Maybe it's exercise. Something that's good. Maybe it's exercise. You know, maybe you've made that an idol, or maybe it's food. You know, it could be something like that. It's normally could be good, but you made an idol out of it. So, I mean, I've mentioned a few so far, so just go ahead and pick yours, and then just in your mind, what we're envisioning now, you just set it up there, okay? If I've named up one of yours, you just set it up there, okay? We're going to do some more. I'll probably hit another couple. So you'll be able to get, in our practice patrol, you'll be able to get a couple of your idols just set up, and we'll see how this works. Haven't named yours yet? Okay, let's think about a few more. Maybe your idol is an ideal, you know, something like the perfect marriage that you're not going to have because your spouse isn't perfect. You know, but you want one and you wish you could have one, and God should have given you one, right? Or a perfect career, you know, and you didn't get that, or you're because your boss is a jerk and so you're miserable. So working for him is definitely not the perfect career, but you know, because you didn't stay in school the way you should, and then someday you're going to get back, and so on. Maybe after the kids grow or whatever. Or maybe it's a dream house. You know, that's what you've set up. And for you, that's even more important than what God might do in your life. Or maybe it's some toy, you know. Kids have toys. Little kids have little toys. Big kids have big toys, right? And, you know, they get on guys about that. Guys and their toys. And you know, but maybe, you know, it's that certain car that someday you're going to get, right? You're going to keep saving. You're going to keep working overtime. You're going to skip church so you can work overtime because you eventually want to get that one. Or maybe it's a certain gun or whatever. Or a jet ski. Or a motorcycle. Or a boat. I have my eye on a three-hull pontoon. I saw it at the gym, by the way. I don't know if that this matters, but and two 200 horsepower motors on it. And why do you want such a powerful what's that kind of boat called? Slipped my mind. Pontoon. Why would you want such a pontoon? Well, because I got like 12, 13 people in my family, and so we want to put them all on the boat, and then also you want to have a ski package. And so you can ski, and everyone's on the pontooning zip around the lake, and I need a really nice boat for that. Well, I don't know, you know, what kind of lady toys are there? I don't know, maybe it's a certain outfit, you know, that's really expensive, you know, like a couple $100 or $300 or $500, I don't know, maybe it's outside of your price range, but you still, you got it up on the, you got a picture of it, and you've saved the, and you're waiting for it's on sale or whatever, you know, and maybe it's a certain hairstyle or something that, I don't know. Maybe it's a cosmetic procedure. You say, oh, no, we won't have to worry about that. I don't know. Some Christians do. I knew a young lady that this is a, this kind of procedure is popular in China. They change the eyelid, and so it looks like a Westerner's eyelid rather than a, like mostly about half covering the eyeball. It's a little different. Maybe you understand what I'm saying. And so this young married woman, she just had to have this procedure, and eventually she got the procedure, and then she was so enamored with her beautiful new eyes and how they flipped, I guess, and how they looked, and how much of her makes her eye look bigger, okay? And then big eyes is an important point of beauty for Asians. And she was so happy with that, and apparently there was some other guy that she knew that he was really happy about that too, and so she ended up leaving her husband for that one, you know, so I think that kind of contributed. But, you know, there's a lot of different eyeballs, so you pick one. I want you to pick, you know, because I'm sure I've hit one or two years. Set it up in there, our practice patrol, all right? You set it up in there, in your mind's eye there. Maybe it's a person. You say a person can be an idol? Oh, sure. Maybe you still have regular dreams of marrying or going back and marrying your high school sweetheart. I don't know, because after all, the one you married is just not working out the way you expected. And surely, if you could have married your high school sweetheart, you would have been happy for the rest of your life, deliriously happy. And so you can't stop thinking about how wonderful that would be. Maybe it's a new sweetheart, you know? Except the problem is they're not a Christian and you are, and you know that's not supposed to work like that. You're not supposed to do that. But after all, you love them so much, so it just must be right. And certainly God is in it. Maybe it's a favorite preacher, and you prefer his preaching above everyone else's, and even if he doesn't match the Bible, he's still right. But of course, you wouldn't know because you never check him. Because you think he's the perfect preacher, and only his sermons are good, and if no one other sermons are any good. Maybe it's a feeling, even. A feeling could be an idol. And there's different kinds of feeling I could describe, and I don't want to go into all of them. Maybe it's just something like the feeling of a vindication and release when you blow up at someone in anger. Some people make an idol out of that. You say they can't control themselves. Well, no, it's not exactly that, because there's ways to control. There's techniques you can use. You can learn around that. You can ask God to help you. So if that's still something you do on a regular basis, that's because it's an idol you have set up. And it's become a stronghold, okay? It's idols are strongholds. So I want you to see that idol in your mind, okay? And when you set it up, I mean, you can make it like the Washington Monument. You can make it that shape if you want, or you can just make it like a pillar. That'd be okay, too. If you want to make it like a totem pole or something and decorate it, or that's okay. You could do that. I mean, certainly you should decorate it, right? I mean, after all, it's one of your favorite things. So I suppose if you're a lady, it might have some nice cloth on it and maybe some lace or something like that. And if it's a guy, you know, maybe he's going to use some really nice clean brush to stainless steel to plate it with, and then maybe get some copper bolts and stuff, you know, so they weather and get some of the green and get that patina on there or something like that. It'd be really nice, right? But actually, that stuff that you've put up there or that's on your idol, that's just a kind of camouflage. That's a camouflage. That's not what it really is. It's an idol. If you would apply some knowledge of God to that idol you have and the picture that you see when you're near it and how it makes you feel, you apply some knowledge of God, you'll see what's really there, and that is, it's an image of death. It's an image of death. It's not that image that makes you carnally happy. It's an image of death. So what we're going to do, rather than we're going to remove the camouflage, and I guess if it's stainless steel, you're going to have to put a little work into it, but we're doing this in our imagination, right? I just want you to take off the camouflage and put what really should be on it. You know, from find some sewer somewhere, some scummy, filthy sewer that's black and tarry. I read an article once about how they have blockages in the sewers. I read an article about one and it has to do some with what people flush down the toilets that are not supposed to flush down, and it gets collected. And they had pictures. It's hard to do because it's all underneath inside the sewer to get down there, and it's a tremendous amount of work to clean them out. They're just these massive blobs, you know, like 3 feet wide and yards long, and they're disgusting and black and tarry, and it's just incredible amount of time they have to put in to clean them out. I want you to get some of that and smear it on there, okay? Black and scummy, and it smells disgusting, doesn't it? You say, no, I don't want to do that. It does. It does. It smells terrible. I don't want to do that. But you think it smells disgusting, but I'll tell you, the rats at the bottom that are walking around and hanging out at the bottom, they like it. And the cockroaches that are crawling on it, they like it. And the maggots that are living on it, they like it. And the bats that are hanging on the top, they like it. Okay? It's an image of death. And these things, I'm trying to give you a picture of the filthiness of the idol. Okay? So, before we go on to the next step, I'll give you one more chance to just go ahead and hug your idol. Okay, you've got it all set up in your head, right? And although we've made it rather disgusting, I'll give you one more chance. Go ahead and hug it, okay? So I'm going to pause for a second. You go ahead and do that. You say, I don't want to hug it anymore. Why not? I mean, just a couple days ago, you were satisfied. I mean, that's the thing you wanted to do. That's what you were glad to hug it. You say, I don't want to hug it now. You say, it's different. Yeah, it's not really different, but we see it in a different way. And that's what we're learning here this evening. If you would examine it and understand as you patrol in these conditions with this mindset, you'll realize that it's the enemy, right? It's a stronghold of the enemy. And it hurts you and has stolen from you and wasted your mental and emotional resources. And it's killing your spiritual life. To be carnally minded is death, right? To be spiritually minded is life and peace. It's killing your spiritual life. So, as we patrol, if we find it, what are we supposed to do? What does it say? It says, pull it down. Cast it down. Cast it down. That's an interesting word. Well, it's really a simple word, of course. Cast is just like throw. But as it's used in several places in the Old Testament, it has some interesting implications, and so I'm just going to read them to you, and you follow these, and you'll understand much better what the Lord is asking of us, or why He wants us to cast these down. For example, it means to cast down with intent to abandon. Cast out this bondwoman and her son, right? Or it's the idea of casting down or casting out with anger. There's maybe an element. There should be an element of anger with it. It says Moses' anger waxed hot and he cast the tables out of his hand. There should be an idea of for the purpose of displacing something. For the Lord said, I will cast out the nations before thee and enlarge thy borders. Displace the enemy, right? to avoid being polluted. And ye shall not walk in the manners of the nation which I cast out before you, for they committed all these things, and therefore I abhorred them. So we might say, we cast these down so that the Lord might not abhor us, right? To remove your enemies, to cast out all thine enemies from before thee as the Lord has spoken. He knows what they are, right? And He wants us to understand them the same way that He does, our enemies. And we should cast them down. You say, well, what about pulling? What about pulling them down? It says that they're in verse 4. Well, to me, the pulling down speaks of the difficulty. Okay? When you think of pulling something down, you think about maybe like throwing some lines around it, and or maybe even something heavier, cable or something, and hooking it to the back end of a heavy vehicle and to pull it down like that. It speaks of the difficulty. Okay? You say, yeah, that's for sure. And I have to admit, that's why I haven't been able to bring very many of them down, because it's difficult. Okay? Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Well, maybe ask God for help. Maybe ask God and say, Lord, how about one of those big war horses that we're going to be able to ride later? Can I just borrow one for a little while as I patrol through my mind? Because I found some rather tall and sturdy idols, high things, and I need some extra weight because I got to pull them down. And I don't have enough weight in myself. I'm just, 150 pounds. I need 500 pounds, 1,000 pounds. I need to throw a rope up there and pull it down. You say, well, don't I have to get rid of my idols before God will help me? Actually, no. You don't have to get rid of all your idols before God will help you. In fact, He'd be glad to help. In fact, He likes to throw down idols. You remember the story of Dagon? Remember reading that back in 1 Samuel chapter 5? And the Philistines had gotten a hold of the ark and they'd stuck it right in Dagon's temple. And this whole thing, it's not the Israelites saying, God, help us, help us. God just did this because He likes to throw down idols. They stuck it in His temple, in Dagon's temple, and the next morning they came and God had just knocked it down. Just for starters, just knocked it down once. And then so they set it back up, and the next morning they came in, and now it's just knocked down, but its head's chopped off and its arms are chopped off. Okay? He just did that for fun. And then they decided, well, I guess we can't keep it here, so let's move it. Actually, not only did he do that, but it says, the hand of the Lord was heavy upon them of Ashdod, and he destroyed them. Okay, not just knocking down the idol. It says he destroyed them. So they decided that, well, we better move it over to Gath, because this is getting too costly to keep it here. And then when they got to Gath, it ends up that the hand of the Lord was against the city, that city, with a great destruction. Okay, and so they try to move they move the ark to another spot, and they moved it down to Akron, And there was also, again, a deadly destruction throughout all the city. So the God, our God, he likes to knock down idols, okay? And if it's the idol of the enemy, he will, like, wipe them back and forth, and he'll follow them around for a while afterwards after he knocked down their idol, okay? He likes to do it. So what you want to do, if you want him to help, is you want to name it, okay? Dagon. He had a name. It wasn't just an idol, okay? It was the idol that was named. So you're going to need to name your idol, and that's what we worked on a little bit there this evening. You need to name it. And if you'll name it, God will help you, and he'll give you a spiritual war horse that it's, the scripture says is mighty through God to the pulling down of these strongholds, because he's not willing that the enemy make inroads in your heart. That's what a stronghold is. The enemy has come in to make an inroad, and he's planted his power there, and he wants to influence. And the Lord is not willing for that to happen. So he will fight for you. Now, there's one more idol that we haven't mentioned yet. And that is mentioned in the last part of 5 and 6. That's the idol of disobedience. That's a bigger idol, okay? That's a bigger one. And if the other idols that you have, they're kind of a somewhat down on the plane, okay? Now this idol is up on the hill, and he's bigger, okay? The idol of disobedience. This idol is the beast of your carnal mind. He's feeding and energizing all the other idols. And if you don't bring this one down, he will seed the others, and they'll come back up. So how are we going to do that? How are you going to get this one? Because he's bigger than the others. Well, you got a word, first of all, the first key, I'm going to give you two, and then we'll finish. The first key is revenge. See that in verse 6? If you're not interested in taking revenge, you're not going to get the job done. You know, the word revenge is only listed in one other place in the New Testament. And that's over there in 2 Corinthians chapter 7. And that is there in a discussion of what is godly repentance, right? And it uses the word revenge there. And so why is revenge connected with repentance? Because it means I'm going to get right and I'm going to get on God's side, okay? Because, I'm going to read something here from Isaiah. It says, "For he put on righteousness as a breastplate and a helmet of salvation upon his head, and he put on the garments of vengeance for clothing and was clad with zeal as a cloak." He's going to take vengeance, okay? So you want to be on his side, right? And that means having the same attitude of, I want to get revenge. Revenge on what? Well, revenge means that I want to get some payback, right? I want to extract an equal portion of what was taken from me, of what I lost. I want to get at least that amount back. I want to get at least the amount back of all the energy that I wasted on my idol. And I want to give that back to God. That's kind of what the attitude of revenge is. And if you have that attitude, which is a result of repentance, and that's another topic, then you'll be prepared to bring down even that one, even that beast. And the other thing it talks about here in chapter 5, he says, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Right? Before, we're talking about an idol that's named disobedience. And so we're going to bring into captivity, in order to bring it down, we're going to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. And you say, well, every thought, it's like there's a lot of them. How am I going to do that? Yeah, there's every thought. That's too many if you're going to do them one by one, maybe. That's too many. But There's an interesting verse in Ephesians chapter 4. And it's referring to when Christ is risen from the grave, and says he led captivity captive. Remember that verse? He led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men. You know, one of the reasons I know that none of the other Bibles are translated by people that have a high level of translation talent? They're just like mediocre translations and mediocre translators. Although they do think highly of themselves, of course, but they're not. You know how I know that? Because they all change this verse. And then they, you know, for example, like the ESV says, he led a host of captives. And the NASV says, led captive a host of captives. And of course, the great NIV says, he took many captives. No, he led captivity captive. He led captivity captive. And gave gifts. What does that mean? Well, he brought me out of my captivity, right? And so if he says, go there, well, I'm going to go there. And if he says, you know, jump, then I'm just going to ask, how high? Because he led me out of captivity, so he can take me wherever he wants, because that was miserable, you know. Maybe you weren't that miserable. I guess you probably just forgot some. And if you're younger, it's good that you weren't that miserable, but if you would have kept on going, you would have eventually got more and more miserable. Bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. But it does sound like kind of a bad word, you know, captive. Like they led away, you know, in war, they led the captives away in chains, right? But that's not what it means here. Not at all. It's like this. The violinist held the audience captive with his playing. That's what it is. Enthralled. And we talked about it, I talked about it the other night, to be enthralled with the excellency of Jesus Christ. And that's going to captivate me. That will take me captive. And you know what? I don't ever like to watch the movies about Jesus Christ. You know, even though, you know, they try to follow the Bible and so on, and I know a lot of people that like them and say they've got a lot out of them and stuff, but it's because they can never play. A man, you think a man can play Jesus Christ? It doesn't matter how good of an actress. He can't play Jesus Christ. Impossible. He's too wonderful. He's too compassionate and patient and righteous. And he's too good of a friend. You can't play that. But I can read about it, and I'm enthralled. So I will be captivated by him, and I will obey him. And that big one up there on the top of the hill, it'll come down. All right, brother, you come ahead. That's all I have for you this evening. Hope that helps.